Welcome to the Corporate Social Responsibility Podcast. I'm your host, David Yosifon, Associate Professor of Law at Santa Clara University School of Law in sunny Santa Clara, California. This is episode 6 of the Corporate Social Responsibility Podcast. I'm recording this in early March of 2014, and our subject matter for today is the first of a series of podcasts that I want to do on the religious rights of corporations. Now, I intend for this podcast series to address issues relating to corporate social responsibility in broadly thematic fashion. That is, I hope that these podcasts will have some duration and relevance to audiences who might come to them many years into the future. This particular podcast is timely in the sense that the United States Supreme Court will soon, that on March 25th, 2014, be hearing oral arguments on a series of cases brought by corporations that are challenging certain aspects of the America Cares Act, the Obamacare federal health care legislation, claiming that their religious rights should entitle them to an exemption from having to comply with certain aspects of Obamacare. In particular, these corporations are claiming that their religious rights should entitle them to an exemption from the requirement to provide health insurance that covers birth control and, according to these corporations, drugs that can induce abortion. So this is presently a hot legal topic, a hot political topic, hot in the sense that it is being actively decided now. However, the normative questions surrounding the religious rights of corporations, whether they should have them, how they should be construed, are bigger than this particular case and will still be just as pressing from a normative perspective, regardless of how the Supreme Court actually comes down on the matter. So I'm doing a series of podcasts on this issue in order to draw attention to the Hobby Lobby case, or the Hobby Lobby cases as they are known. But I want the conversations here to have a broader perspective, one that will inform thinking about and debates about these issues that reach far beyond the particular outcome of this case. Today's episode brings to you an interview with a highly esteemed constitutional law professor who I think will provides us in this interview with an erudite, very thorough background on the constitutional and normative questions that are wrapped up in this debate. My guest has a very different view about the religious rights of corporations than I have, but I'm very happy to give voice to views very different from mine in this podcast series. Next week, I'm going to have an interview with another prominent legal scholar who will offer yet another or differing perspective on this issue of the religious rights of corporations. Please subscribe to us on iTunes so that you get our podcast automatically downloaded to you. Follow us on Twitter at David Yosifon. That's David Yosifon. And I will tweet it anytime that we post a new episode in this Corporate Social Responsibility podcast series. With no further ado, on to today's guest. We have with us now Professor Eugene Volokh, the Gary T. Schwartz Professor of Law at UCLA School of Law. Professor Volokh clerked for Judge Alex Kaczynski on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and he clerked for Justice Sandra Day O'Connor on the U.S. Supreme Court. Professor Volokh is an expert, I think, in many areas of law, but especially First Amendment law, and he blogs at the Volokh Conspiracy. If you follow legal theoretic issues or doctrinal issues in many areas, you are certainly familiar with the Volokh Conspiracy. If you're just coming to these issues, I hope that you will become a fan of the Volokh Conspiracy after listening to this podcast. Professor Volokh, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us this afternoon.
And thank you so much for having me on.
So our general theme today is the religious rights of corporations, and I hope that we can discuss the issue somewhat broadly, but our point of departure certainly is as the issue comes to us through the Affordable Care Act.
in which many corporations that have 50 or more employees are required to provide health insurance to its employees that includes birth control, including drugs that can induce abortion. Now, a number of corporations have claimed that they should not be required to abide by this regulation because it contradicts their religious beliefs. Can you start us off by breaking down for us or explaining to us why it is that this case is likely to be decided not as a constitutional issue, but as an issue deciding rights that arise under a statutory regime?
Sure. So about 50 years ago, the Supreme Court held that people who have religious objections to generally applicable laws have a presumptive constitutional right to an exemption from those laws. So, for instance, there's one famous case about 10 years later in which Amish parents wanted their children to go to school only up to age 14. Wisconsin law said everybody, didn't single out the Amish, said everybody has to send their kids to school until age 16. And the court said, well, the Amish are constitutionally entitled to an exemption from that law. Then, in 1990, the Supreme Court reversed course. And it said, in an opinion written by Justice Scalia, and joined by Justices Rehnquist and Kennedy, so three conservatives, but also joined by moderate Justice White and moderate to liberal Justice Stevens, the Supreme Court held that there is no such entitlement, generally speaking, with a few exceptions. That generally speaking, religious objectors have to abide by the same laws that everybody else abides by and have no right to constitutional right to an exemption, although the legislature could, if it wanted to, give them such an exemption. That was a very controversial decision, and 3 years later, a very broad coalition, it was a unanimous vote in the House, I think, nearly unanimous vote in the Senate, this broad left-right ACLU, conservative religious coalition, enacted a statute it's called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. And it purported, as a matter of statute, to give religious objectors rights to exemption from generally applicable laws. Not always, but when religious objectors' religious beliefs or religious practices are substantially burdened by a generally applicable law. For example, if, like the Amish, they're told to do something that their religion forbids, or they are told to not do something that their religion requires, or they're told that they will lose a lot of money if they do something that the religion requires, then in that case, the person gets an exemption unless the government can show that denying the exemption is the least restrictive means of serving a compelling government interest. So that's supposed to be a pretty strong presumption in favor of religious exemptions. The Supreme Court, a few years later, held that that statute could not constitutionally be applied to state and local governments. It was outside federal government's power to bind state and local governments this way. But as the federal government, it remains. To give an example from several years ago, there is a very small religious group that believes that a particular hallucinogenic substance called huasca, which is indigenous to Brazil, is religiously required for their rituals. And the Supreme Court unanimously said, well, under this Religious Freedom Restoration Act statute, these people are entitled to an exemption, that the law substantially, the drug laws, substantially burden their religious practice. And the government didn't show there was a compelling government interest here in supporting this application of this particular drug law. Even if the drug law is generally sound, there's no compelling interest in denying an exemption to these religious objectors. So it's a pretty complex scheme, but it's a scheme enacted by statute. I should say also about half the states have either a similar statute or have interpreted their state constitutions as providing as a matter of state constitutional law these exemptions. So in some states, you can't get an exemption from state and local law unless the legislature gives it to you. In other states, you have similar regimes, and at the federal level, you have this regime as well. Now, this is all a very big picture point. There's still questions about what constitutes a substantial burden in particular situations, and of course, there is a hot controversy about the degree to which this statute should be seen as applying to closely held corporations.
So as we are examining this particular question with respect to the Affordable Care Act, can pretty much assume that if it were only constitutional rights that were at issue, if this is a law of general application and it wasn't passed for the particular purpose of restraining a religious practice but was rather promulgated on neutral grounds, we could pretty much assume that there wouldn't be a constitutional right to an exemption for either a natural person or a corporation. But we're now looking at whether the Religious Freedom Restoration Act provides by statute a broader right to access a religious exemption. And now the question is whether or not an individual or a corporation is going to be able to claim it in this context.
That is about right. It's a little bit more complicated than that. There is actually a free exercise clause challenge brought in one of the cases that the court has agreed to hear. And there's some extra debate about just the scope of free exercise clause protections following this Employment Division versus Smith decision, the decision from the 1990 that said generally no exemptions as a constitutional matter. So I can't say that there's absolutely no chance there's going to be a free exercise clause claim prevailing here. But I do think it's the weaker of the two claims, and by a lot. It's the RFRA claim. RFRA is the way the Religious Freedom Restoration Act abbreviation is usually pronounced. It's the RFRA claim that is, by all means, the stronger one here.
I think it's important to bear that distinction in mind as we're addressing the issue of the rights of corporations in this context, because many people would find it a more fundamental question if we were debating whether, as a constitutional matter, corporations had the right to religious exemptions, as opposed to just debating whether this statute provides for them, given that it's a lot easier to change a statute if it turned out that we didn't like this particular policy as it applies to corporations.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's one advantage that this RFRA model gives to religious exemption claimants. And it's also the same as the disadvantage. If you look at it from the perspective of somebody who wants to have there be more religious exemptions for all sorts of groups, organizations like the Beckett Fund, which is representing one of the claimants here, is generally in favor of religious exemptions for a vast range of religious groups that defended people, Christians, non-Christians, all sorts of denominations. So they might say on the one hand, well, too bad that we are stuck with the statute. Rather than having this constitutional claim as it was from 1963 to 1990, because if we have stuck with the statute, then what happens is Congress, if it disagrees with a court decision, can just reverse it by statute, by saying, oh, well, the Affordable Care Act will be exempted from RFRA, assuming they can get votes for that, which probably at this point they can't, but in principle they could. Or, well, we don't like the corporations are covered by RFRA. We're going to pass a statute that says RFRA shall not apply to corporations. So on one hand, this RFRA model is therefore worse for religious claimants. On the other hand, for the same reason, it may be better, because a court might be very skittish about saying, Congress has no power to do this. Congress must provide exemptions from the statute. Congress must cover corporations. A court might say, well, really, do we have kind of an open and shut argument as to why the legislature's hands are tied this way? And they may be reluctant to do that. On the other hand, when they're applying RFRA, first of all, they can say, look, if Congress doesn't approve of this interpretation, you know, they can always change it, again, assuming they have the votes. If they don't like the fact that we're carving out an exemption from the Affordable Care Act, well, if they had the votes, they could just, by through the normal legislative process, repeal that exemption. If they don't like the fact that we are applying this to corporations, well, they could just say, RFRA shall not apply to corporations. And on top of that, the rhetoric in these RFRA claims isn't, should the courts judgment trump the legislature's judgment. Rather, because they're applying a statute, they say, hey, we're just implementing the legislature's judgment. Congress told us to carve out these exemptions, didn't give us a very clear standard, but we're going to try to muddle through as best we can. You don't like it, go back to Congress. But we are just implementing the popular will, albeit the popular will embodied in RFRA, rather than, say, in the Affordable Care Act. And in fact, if you look at that decision, the WASCA decision involving this hallucinogenic drug, which is a unanimous decision upholding a religious exemption claim, that's a very rare thing at the Supreme Court level, it was replete with these statements about how, well, we're following Congress's will. Congress told us to do this. It's a hard process of trying to figure out what's the least restrictive means of serving a compelling government interest, but that's our job, as Congress told us to. The fact that it's a statutory claim may actually be substantially in favor of the claimants here, not just because the statute provides a substantively broader rule, but because it may embolden courts to read that to apply that rule more broadly.
And for those of us observing it, I suppose it makes it a much hotter political question, because it makes it a much more plausible path towards reforming whatever rule comes out of the Supreme Court by ordinary politics.
Yeah. What's interesting, of course, about this particular statute is it's a rare situation where between the time a statute was enacted and the time that an exemption claim is brought, the political dynamic has changed markedly. If the Obama administration had essentially tried to figure out a way of enacting a much more modest version of this that would have had broad bipartisan support, then this wouldn't be much of an issue, because indeed Congress would be ready right then and there, if it doesn't like the court decision, the very next day, propose a bill that changes it, no problem. But given that the bill was so much just a Democratic bill, and didn't, I think, even get all the votes of all the Democrats, and given that as a result it was such a close matter, and then on top of that it led to the backlash which flipped the House, at this point it's true that the court decision is much more likely to be final, because even though in theory Congress might reverse it, in practice it seems very unlikely given the current politics. But I think the court will be much more focused on this theoretical point, on saying, look, we are applying a statute, it's a statutory decision, it could be reversed by Congress if there is political will to do that, probably won't be political will to do that, but that's not our lookout. The other thing to keep in mind, for whatever it's worth, and I think as a matter of statutory construction, I don't think it should be worth much, but as a matter of democratic legitimacy, on the one hand, the Affordable Care Act is more recent than RFRA. RFRA was enacted 20 years ago. On the other hand, the Affordable Care Act is a total squeaker, whereas RFRA was, as I said, unanimous in one House and nearly unanimous in the other. So at least at one point, there really was a very broad support for the notion of, A, having religious exemptions from generally applicable laws, and B, leaving it to courts to make these kinds of decisions. So I think subconsciously, I mean, courts generally don't look to, well, what was the margin of passage? But I think subconsciously this might affect their judgment, and may affect the judgment of also some observers who are asking, is the court behaving illegitimately? Is the court behaving undemocratically? Well, it is enacting a law that was passed by nearly unanimous vote. It is implementing a law, that was passed by nearly unanimous vote.
Now, despite that broad consensus behind the RFRA when it was passed, or perhaps because of the broad consensus, the Congress that passed it did not have much to say in its in the development of the legislation about whether or not RFRA should apply to corporations, or certainly to for-profit corporations. Is that right?
So I think that's right. I think it's hard to distinguish for-profit corporations from non-profit corporations as a matter of the statutory text. But yes, nothing in the text says anything about whether a corporation or not. It's kind of, RFRA provides protections for persons. And the Dictionary Act in Title I of the U.S. Code, essentially kind of a little introduction to the U.S. Code, says that persons shall include corporations unless the context indicates otherwise. So in a sense, there's something of a presumption that when Congress talks about persons, it's also including corporations, because that's also right there in a statute, not RFRA itself, but the Dictionary Act. On the other hand, it does say, unless context otherwise indicates, so then the question for the court will be, well, is there something about this context that otherwise indicates? that indicates that this shouldn't apply to corporations.
And what is your view of that, either of the statutory interpretation specifically, or more generally, whether a statutory scheme that purports to provide exemptions for religious practice should include corporations as having access to those exemptions?
Well, let me speak generally. I think that legal fictions are often very useful things, but we must never make the mistake of actually believing our legal fictions as opposed to just using them. So I agree to some point with those who say, look, a corporation isn't a human. Rights are held by humans in a moral sense. Therefore, a corporation as such, it has no soul, it doesn't pray, it doesn't worship, it doesn't have a conscience. It itself cannot literally have rights. So I think that much is absolutely true. But there's a flip side to that as well, that when a corporation is burdened, when there's an obligation imposed in a corporation, especially in a closely held corporation, we have to also look behind the fiction of the corporation there, and we have to recognize that that's a burden on people. When corporations are burdened, people are burdened. When closely held corporations are burdened, the owners of the corporation are, generally speaking, burdened. And here's one way I think of thinking about this that helps us avoid kind of the emotional and moral judgments that apply to the Affordable Care Act as such and questions about contraception and the like. Let's just have a situation where there's a burden imposed on a corporation with something a lot less controversial. Let's say some state that has a lottery says, you know, we really want to sell more lottery tickets because that's good for the schools because that's where the money comes. So what we're going to do is we're going to say that anybody who owns a store, let's say a convenience store, must sell tickets, lottery tickets, or face a substantial fine. Let's say Alan owns a store, and let's say Alan is a Methodist or at least certain branches of Methodism or Mormon or I think Muslim. These groups, at least various branches of those groups, believe that it's wrong to gamble. And they may also believe, I think may vary a bit from person to person, that it's wrong to essentially assist gambling. And that let's assume that Alan therefore sincerely believes, as a matter of his religious beliefs, that it is wrong for him to sell lottery tickets or to allow lottery tickets to be sold on his property. That would be a classic religious exemption claim under RFRA. Or if it's a state regulation or state RFRA statute, if there is one. Because there's a substantial burden on the property owner, on the business owner, it's requiring him to do something on pain of a financial penalty that would violate his religious beliefs. By hypothesis, he sincerely believes it's wrong for him to aid gambling by selling lottery tickets or by allowing lottery tickets to be sold in the store. And then, of course, the question would be if there's a compelling government interest and whether denying the exemption is necessary to serve that government interest. So that's Alan. So pretty clearly, RFRA would apply to him, although it's an interesting question whether the government could say, oh, there's a compelling interest in promoting the lottery. Now let's look at Bob. Bob is right next door to Alan, also owns a store, but he owns the store through a corporation. Because as you know, and I'm sure your listeners know, the law gives so many advantages to corporations. That most business people organize them as corporations, even very closely held ones. And it's especially so if Bob actually owns it with his wife, let's say, Roberta, or with his brother, Bill. Bob and Bill, let's say, co-own the store, and as a result, rather than just having a common law partnership, they have a corporation. And let's say they have the same religious beliefs as Alan. On the one hand, I think it's a mistake to say the corporation's religious beliefs are burdened. At least it's a mistake to say that as a literal matter. Literally speaking, the corporation is a fiction. It has no beliefs to be burdened. But Bob's and Bill's religious beliefs and religious practices are burdened. And to say, well, no, the law doesn't require you to sell tickets, lottery tickets on what's your property. It's only requiring it that it be sold on the corporation's property. As it happens, you are the sole owners of the corporation, but hey, it's not the same as you owning it. They could say, well, wait a minute, it is the same. My religious beliefs require me to look at reality and not legal fictions. Therefore, this is a burden on our practice, and either, therefore, you should allow us to raise our own religious exemption claims, or for convenience, you could say, even though this is something of a fiction, it's still a useful legal fiction. We're going to allow the corporation to assert the constitutional rights of its owners. I think that's a pretty powerful religious exemption claim. And I think the fact that the coercion, the governmental coercion, goes through this fiction of the corporation doesn't keep it from being coercion, doesn't make Bob and Bill's situation really any different from Alan's. Now, one can still dispute, for example, again, whether there's a compelling interest behind the law. You could say, well, ACA is different because it's so important that people get this kind of contraceptives. That's fine, but that's a strict scrutiny argument. That's a compelling interest argument. That's not an argument about whether corporations should have RFRA rights. And for purposes of this question about corporations, I think the convenience store and lottery analogy is actually a pretty on-point one. And I, if my intuition is correct, and that indeed in this convenience store situation, the owners should be able to raise a religious exemption claim either by themselves or through their corporation, then I think the same should apply to the ACA.
And if we were to say to Bob, look, you can have the religious exemption, you just then don't get to organize as a corporation, your point is that saying that you don't get access to the benefits of a corporation that you would otherwise have access to, that in itself is a substantial burden?
That is right. You could imagine a legal rule that's different. You could imagine a legal rule that says, look, the government RFRA applies only to commands that you cannot avoid. And if it's a command that you could avoid, even at substantial cost in terms of forfeiting various government benefits, well, too bad for you. You could imagine that kind of way of crafting RFRA. It's pretty clearly not what RFRA requires for the following reason. Remember, RFRA is the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Congress was upset at this decision in Employment Division versus Smith that reversed these almost 30 years of at least situation where at least in theory people had these presumptive exemptions. And it specifically singled out two cases, Sherbert v. Verner and Wisconsin v. Yoder, as cases that Congress liked and wanted to restore. And it also said more broadly that it wanted to restore the pre-Smith federal law of religious exemptions. Turns out that the first of those cases, Sherbert, the 1963 case that announced this whole constitutional exemption regime, that case involved denial of a government benefit. It involved Adele Sherbert, who was a Seventh-day Adventist, so she felt that she shouldn't work on the Sabbath, which to her was a Saturday. She was fired by her employer for not working on Saturday. There was no Title VII question or anything like that back then because it was before Title VII. And she applied for unemployment compensation. South Carolina court said, no, you don't get unemployment compensation because unemployment compensation happens to people who quit or who are either laid off without misconduct on their part or quit for good cause. Mm-hmm. Whereas you just quit because you don't want to work on Saturdays. Mm-hmm. And the Supreme Court said that is unconstitutional. That denial is unconstitutional. Sherbert is entitled to a constitutional exemption from this generally applicable rule. And that's so even though she wasn't actually legally forced to work on Saturdays. It's not like if you don't work on Saturdays, you'll go to jail. It's just if you don't go to work on Saturdays, you give up this benefit. You choose. You can either work on Saturdays and then retain your eligibility for employment compensation, or you can not work on Saturdays, in which case you just have to give up this benefit that we're only giving to people who are willing to follow employer rules regardless of their religious beliefs. And so that choice argument was there. It was made. But the court said, no. Denying you unemployment compensation is a substantial burden. I would say the same thing with regard to corporate status, especially for a larger business. It is so vital to have corporate status, not just for a limitation of liability, but just so that you could organize organize your financial transactions in a way that that just all other businesses do, that many businesses expect, that the legal system facilitates through making it easy to sue and be sued in the name of the corporation and the like. So I think that that the court is not likely to say, hey, you know, you this isn't any burden because all you need to do is give up your corporate status, just like it wouldn't say to Sherbert, all you need to do is give up your unemployment compensation.
Now, in the very thoughtful blogging that you've done on this subject already at the Vol Conspiracy, you make the case, I think, that you assume or you think that that RFRA is probably only going to apply to closely held corporations. Can you explain why you think that is on a statutory basis or, again, on a normative basis, whether you think it should apply to just to closely held corporations or what about publicly held corporations?
Yeah, so I think that the difference with a publicly held corporation is that with a publicly held corporation, owners really are in much more of a position to avoid the burden simply by selling their shares. I own all sorts of stocks that's the way my wife and my savings are invested. If I don't like some corporation, it is a very easy and relatively inexpensive matter to sell the stock in that. That's just not true, generally speaking, for closely held corporations. There's not really a market for shares in closely held corporations. Very often, closely held corporate status is connected to family businesses where it becomes very difficult to sell outside the family. Very often, the owners of a closely held corporation are also its managers. So while I think the line is not completely sharp, for example, some people find it hard to sell their stock because it's owned through retirement funds and the like, but still I think there's a significant line between a closely held corporation where either giving up corporate status or selling your shares in the corporation is very burdensome, and a publicly held corporation where selling your shares in a corporation is something people do routinely and with very little expense.
Well, you just alluded to one of my follow-up questions, but maybe we can pursue it a little further. Wonder if, you probably, as I have no idea what kinds of corporations my retirement investments are placed in, and I doubt that you do too. There's very high transactions cost to even finding out what kind of companies you're involved in when you have a highly diversified portfolio. Wouldn't that be a kind of burden or insurmountable burden for most highly diversified investors?
I'm not sure I quite see why that would be so. Remember that in a typical situation, what happens is that somebody says, oh, I have a religious belief that I ought not invest in companies that do X. If you really have that belief, then presumably either your religious belief is sort of on a mens rea basis. I shouldn't knowingly do it, but if I don't know, then God doesn't mind. Or you say, yes, I think it's religiously wrong for me to invest in companies, let's say, that sell alcohol. Well, if that's so, you're going to have to be out there monitoring what companies sell alcohol in any of it. It has nothing to do with any government-imposed burdens. You'd have to, if this is really your religious belief, you'd have to know what it is that you're investing in. And you might, for example, go to some fund that promises we're only going to invest in companies that don't sell alcohol or something along those lines. But in any event, if you really do have this religious belief, chances are you've got a pretty good idea of where it is that you're investing. And if not, you'd have to figure it out in any case, quite regardless of any government-imposed burden. For a closely held corporation, generally speaking, the owners do know what it is the corporation is doing, or at least it isn't that hard for them to find out.
Well, what if you had an individual who believed that they were forbidden from being an owner or a part owner of a company that provided health insurance that covered birth control drugs? Now, the ACA requires large publicly held corporations to provide such health care. So now this individual is precluded from investing in any such firms. Isn't that a substantial burden then on the individual?
Well, you know, I'm not much of an investor. My sense is that if you don't invest in the stock market, there are lots of other ways you can invest. But indeed, if your belief really is that I can't invest in anything that has anything to do with it, I can't put money in a bank that does it because that is improper. I can't deal with a credit card company that does it, that does this. Then in that case, there might be a substantial burden. But there, it is pretty clear that there is a compelling government interest in denying an exemption. There's really no feasible way for the government to accomplish its goals and grant exemptions for these kinds of small investors, because then the only way to do that is they essentially have to completely abolish the entire law as to all businesses. That's a situation where, in fact, the interest would be so compelling as to justify denying the exemption. But one of the points of RFRA is it's not enough just to say, well, in theory, in some situations, we might need to deny some exemptions, so let's just deny them all. The whole premise of RFRA is to say, well, if a particular objector has an exemption that can be accommodated without that much difficulty, that's something that should be done. On the other hand, if it is very difficult to accommodate, then it shouldn't be done. Just to give another example, imagine, for instance, that Adele Sherbert, the one who said, I can't work on Saturdays. Imagine that she had said, you know, my religious belief is that I should just quit my job and have more time to contemplate God. There, I think, a court might well say, well, okay, accommodating that religious belief might in fact cripple the entire unemployment insurance system, because then everybody could quit their job whenever they wanted to and just say, well, I want to contemplate God. So that might be a situation where a court would say, look, we're going to have to deny the exemption because granting it is too costly. But when the exemption request is something considerably narrower and easier to accommodate, because a lot fewer people are going to make that claim, then in that case it has to be accommodated. Or to put it another way, I sympathize with concerns about slippery slopes, with concerns about what happens if everybody makes this claim, what happens if somebody starts making claims that are too expensive. That is, in fact, one of the reasons why the Supreme Court in 1990 said, we're not going to go along with this compelled constitutional exemptions scheme anymore. We're afraid of where the bottom of the slope is going to be, and we don't want to have to draw lines on the slope. Perfectly plausible argument. That's what five justices bought in Employment Division versus Smith. But it is pretty clearly not the position that RFRA is enacting. In fact, RFRA is a reaction to that position. And it says, look, courts should draw lines, and if an exemption is too difficult to accommodate, you don't have to accommodate it. But if it's not that hard to accommodate, you should accommodate.
How would you assess the situation of a corporation, a large publicly traded corporation? What's interesting about Hobby Lobby and some of these other firms is these are large firms that are privately held, large firms that are closely held. So they're not the mom-and-pop Jewish deli or the mom-and-pop liquor store. They're the mom-and-pop giant corporation. But suppose we had a large publicly traded corporation that was specifically chartered as a religious corporation, or a corporation that was chartered as specifically formed to do business, for-profit business, but in a way that was consistent with a specific religious outlook, and that behaved in conformity with those those scriptures.
I don't think that should be significant for purposes of RFRA in either direction. I don't think that the convenience store has to be chartered as a Methodist or possibly a Mormon convenience store in order for them to be able to lodge a RFRA claim when they're being required to sell lottery tickets, or for that matter, say, to sell alcohol. I don't think that a Jewish market has to be chartered as a religiously Jewish market in order for them to claim an exemption, assuming, let's say, there's some law that says you have to be open 24/7 and you can't close on Saturdays. On the other hand, I think if you're a public health corporation, even if the people who organized you chartered you as having kind of a religious mission statement, I think the burden on individual stockholders in the corporation, which is what I think is really important here, is not going to be that different just because, for a publicly held corporation, just because that happens to be in the mission statement. If they want to, they can sell their shares. So I think it's more important whether it's a closely held corporation or a publicly held corporation. In fact, I think it's the one thing that's important for purposes of this question, and not what happens to be in its bylaws.
Let me push you on that a little bit. If you were a small corporation, the mom and pop Jewish deli, and you charter a corporation, And in your articles of incorporation, you specify that this corporation is formed for the purpose of undertaking any lawful act, as opposed to specifying in the articles of incorporation that you're formed to undertake the operation of a business in a way that conforms with the requirements of the Jewish faith. The corporation itself is reserving to itself the right to undertake any lawful act. Why shouldn't we require it to specify that it is restricted in what it can do to the Jewish faith or whichever faith, if we want the corporation then to be able to formally claim those rights?
Well, I think two reasons. One is it becomes sort of this odd trap for the unwary. My guess is if a Methodist wants to buy a corner market, and even if he knows enough or hires a lawyer to spend half an hour drafting up articles of incorporation, he's not thinking about, will I have to be required to sell lottery tickets? There are no such laws right now. He's just probably thinking, look, I just want to run my business. This happens to be a convenient way of doing it. To say after the fact, no, you didn't have this provision in your charter, I think is a trap for the unwary, and misses the important point, which is that there is, in either situation, whether it's there in the charter or not, this is a burden on this person's religious beliefs. That's what I think should matter for RFRA purposes. So that's one reason. The second reason, which I suppose is related, is, again, I share with some of the critics of corporate rights. I don't agree with them on the bottom line, but I share with them the conclusion that we shouldn't believe the fiction that a corporation has a religion. Corporations don't have religions. Corporations don't really exist. Corporations are networks of contracts. Corporations are fictional entities created by the state. But they're owned by human beings. And if we're talking about RFRA, the purpose of which is to prevent burdens on the practice of religion, which is to say practice of religion by human beings, the real question is, how does this law affect this practice of religion? And that, I think, cannot be answered by asking, well, did they think at the time they were chartering the corporation to add this particular clause to the articles? And if it is answered, that I assume, I'm not an expert in corporate law, but I assume that that the owners of the corporation could basically charter a new corporation, transfer all the assets from the old to the new, pay a bunch of lawyers a bunch of money, and still get to the result. Nothing says, as I understand it, that articles of incorporation, especially of closely held businesses, are set in stone. They could probably be amended, but even if they can't be amended, as I said, a new corporation could be created. So it becomes kind of this weird formal requirement, it sounds like to me, that is not sensitive to the real issues, which is what is the burden of the law on human beings. So that's why I wouldn't look too closely inside the corporate charter.
Well, interesting that you note that you might amend the articles of incorporation, but certainly harder to do so than to adopt an ordinary corporate policy or an ordinary corporate statement of outlook.
All right, so the Hobby Lobby people will have to, as I said, hire some lawyers, pay them, I don't know, tens of thousands of dollars to go through, jump through all these hoops. In the end, will presumably be Hobby Lobby with those particular statements in the articles of incorporation. What's the upside? And what's the upside either for furthering the interests behind the Affordable Care Act or for furthering the interests behind the Religious Freedom Restoration Act?
Well, it was leading to this question for you, which is that there seems to be unanimity within the family that owns Hobby Lobby. And in the hypotheticals we've discussed, there's unanimity. Would it make a difference to you if the family that owned Hobby Lobby was bitterly divided, but yet the controlling block of shares that controlled the board wanted it to maintain this religious position, but that there was a distinct minority within the firm that was objecting to it, or that didn't object, rather?
I agree this creates a more difficult question. I will say, though, if there's majority support for particular religiously motivated belief, then it seems to me, first, you know, I don't see why the law should protect the rights in this instance of the minority of the shareholders as opposed to the majority of the shareholders. And relatedly, I do think that people, even people who don't look closely at the Articles of Incorporation, recognize when they're going into business together as a corporation that there is a general rule of majority rules, unless, of course, the majority is going against, in a major way, the interests of the minority. But that's not the situation here. Usually it would be a situation, I take it, where the majority feels a strong religious objection and the minority says, well, we don't feel the same objection. And in that situation, I don't see why the minority should prevail. So that's my tentative sense. But I agree it would be a tougher question. One way of thinking about this, by the way, is I think you'd mentioned to me that you, in general, write a good deal about corporate social responsibility. I think that provides an interesting and helpful analogy, obviously limited because it more goes to kind of how we think ethically about some of these matters rather than as a purely legal matter, but I think it helps illustrate the legal issues. Let's say somebody, for example, thinks that that it's wrong to do business back in the day with South Africa. I take it if somebody were to say, well, yeah, I'm a big businessman, and I appreciate your arguments about how it's wrong to do business with South Africa, but I don't do business with South Africa. I own a corporation, and it does business with South Africa, but hey, I don't do business with South Africa. I think people would say, oh, don't hide behind this fiction of a corporation. When it comes to your ethical obligations extend to corporations that at least you are in the position to control. So if that's right, if that kind of moral judgment is right, then I don't think we can easily poo-poo the moral judgment or the religious judgment of the owners of Hobby Lobby who say, look, you're telling me that, there's no burden on my religious practice because it's only being imposed in the corporation, but I am just as responsible for what my corporation does as this the executive in the South Africa hypothetical, just as he would be morally culpable under a moral view that it's wrong to do business with South Africa, so I would be morally and religiously culpable in the eyes of God, for having my corporation do something that I personally would be forbidden to do. Likewise, it seems to me that in the South Africa example, I don't think that it matters whether, again, for ethical purposes here, whether there was some official statement in the bylaws, and we're going to be operating in a way that's especially sensitive to moral and ethical obligations. I think we would say, look, everybody should feel this kind of ethical obligation, regardless of what the corporation says. To be sure, if the ethical obligation ends up being so costly to minority shareholders, then maybe that becomes a breach of some fiduciary duty. But assuming it's not particularly costly, that's something that corporations, as I understand it, generally are allowed to do, to take into account these kinds of social and moral concerns. And if that's so, that's so regardless of what the articles say. If, again, this hypothetical executive were to say, yes, I firmly believe that it's wrong to do business with South Africa, but my corporation doesn't believe that. The one that I own, 100%. How do I know? In its bylaws, it never says that it believes that. So as a result, really, the corporation isn't doing anything wrong, and I'm not doing anything wrong because I'm not the corporation. I think we'd say, you're being a hypocrite. If you were to say, I don't think there's anything wrong with doing business with South Africa, we might or might not agree with you, but at least you'd be acting consistently. But if you say it's wrong to do business with South Africa, but my corporation doesn't believe it, my solely owned corporation or my closely held corporation doesn't believe it because it doesn't say that anywhere in its Articles of Incorporation, likewise, you'd be hiding behind a legal fiction. And I think that's not something that makes sense ethically. I don't think it makes sense, at least in this instance, legally.
I think that's a very, very thoughtful entree into the whole question of the religious rights of corporations. And it strikes me as somewhat ironic when you look at the way the political affiliations are likely to line up here, is that I think you would find many people who are generally of the view that corporations should behave in a socially responsible manner would nevertheless also find themselves saying that they don't think that corporations should have religious rights, or that corporations should in any event be required to abide by the ACA. And I think that's an irony or a contradiction that really needs to be worked out by thoughtful inquiry. And you've you've really helped us do that through this conversation. I thank you very much for your time, Professor Volokh, and
very
for
writing on pleasure. This.
We will continue reading the Volokh Conspiracy to see your thoughts on this issue as they continue to develop, and I hope we can have you as a guest on another subject or on this subject as it continues to develop.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, that's it. That's our interview with Eugene Volokh, providing our first entree overview into this very compelling problem of the religious rights of corporations. I'm really grateful for Professor Volokh's perspective. I have to say that I had certain views that I was relatively deeply committed to walking into the interview. After my interview with Professor Volokh, I wasn't so sure what I thought anymore. And that, to me, is the sign of a successful intellectual excursion. When you leave it more confused than you went into it, you know you've been challenged, you've been educated, and the next time you provisionally come to a sense of what it is you think on the matter, it's going to be a richer, deeper understanding, which hopefully you'll be able to hold on to for at least a short while until you expose yourself to another set of thoughts, another set of arguments that dislodges you once again. This episode of the Corporate Social Responsibility Podcast was sponsored by the Markla Center for Applied Ethics here at Santa Clara University, and I'm grateful for their sponsorship. Follow us on Twitter at David Yosifon, that's David, YOSIFON. I'll post it every time we're tweeting a new episode. Subscribe to us on iTunes, then you'll get episodes automatically downloaded. Thanks very much for listening. Got no outro music for you. Got no bells and whistles. I don't think we need it. Let the enormity of the problems we're engaging be the backbeat, the rhythm, the melody, the harmony that leads you out of this conversation and into the rest of your day. I hope you enjoy it. Thanks for listening.